Hey, if we don't know each other, my name's Chris. I have the pleasure of serving as the lead pastor here, and I'm just super grateful for that. We have a special privilege today. I guess I'll intro him in just a second. Hugh Halter is going to come and speak, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute. But 17 years ago, my wife and I had just found a new church, and we were coming out of a season of kind of my dad was a pastor in ministry, and we kind of left the church I kind of grew up at. The Lord was directing us in different ways, and we get to this new church, and it's a very different church than what my wife and I had certainly been raised in. And we get invited to a leadership kind of cohort, and there are several books in this leadership cohort that we would read and go through to help not only develop our leadership skills, but also our theology. And one of the books was a book called Tangible Kingdom, written by the guy that's going to come and talk with us here in just a second, Hugh Halter. And this was one of the first times in my journey with Jesus, which at this point had only been probably a few years, 2 or 3 years, where the scriptures were unpacked in such a way that I began to see a relationship with God as more than just a really cool gathering. And if we're not careful, that's kind of, these walls become like a prison for God in our hearts and in our minds, right? He lives here, and you know, when we go throughout all the different things in our walk, we come back here so that we can convene with him. One of the things in this book that just kind of, I guess, stirred something in me as he unpacked the scriptures was this idea of a tangible kingdom. The already but not yet, as Jesus has come and established this kingdom that we as his sons and daughters are now royal priesthood in, and we function in the kingdom, and the kingdom has no bounds. It is in all places and everywhere, and over the years to come, he would write many more books, and one of the books that he wrote is going to kind of unpack some of the tension of this idea that discipleship, oftentimes we think is here. Sit under teaching, go to a Bible study, those different things. But what if discipleship was more than that? What if our families were more than just a little unit? And so we're going to discuss some things, specifically one of the things from one of his books called Righteous Brood. Come on up, give it up for Hugh Halter. What's up, brother?
No coffee?
No coffee. I literally just spilt my coffee on myself 30 seconds ago.
Done it a thousand times.
Yeah, I'm just glad it didn't get somewhere really embarrassing.
Church, you know what I mean? Church that we pastor in Denver, they stopped letting me bring coffee up on the, because they got tired of cleaning up after me. So,
I get that. So, if y'all don't know, Hugh has been here with us all weekend for the men's gathering, and man, what a blessing that you have been, brother.
Great. That guy liked me.
yes, he did. So, this book, Righteous Brood, I guess, yep. I haven't given them any information about it at all. So, I wanted to, I guess, back up and go, what would make you write this book? And I think that might set up to what the book is and all those different things.
Yeah, good morning, by the way. It's been great to be out here. My age is great to be anywhere. So, Righteous Brood is the name of a subtitle, will help a little bit more. It's something about your family on mission, and brood just means family. It's a weird name for family. So I actually wrote it because I started writing it 12, 15 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Back in the Tangible Kingdom days, because of how our family just was kind of naturally living. We had started several churches, but our churches started, all of them, out of our house. My son Ryan had really severe epilepsy his whole life from the first day he was born, and so we got to where we could actually not leave the house as a family. Like, we couldn't load the minivan and just go somewhere. So my wife, one day, she said, why don't we just play the hand we're dealt and just learn how to open up our home to the neighborhood. So we just started to do that. We started to think about the week and then go, hey, when can we have some people over? And it was mostly just parties and hanging out with people. And then we just found that people moved towards God, and a lot of our friends came to faith, and a lot of our kids' friends, and then people asked us to help them kind of live like we were living in other neighborhoods. But so that's the backdrop. We weren't thinking of like some weird way to do ministry. We just thought, let's play the hand we're dealt. We're a family. We've got some severe disability with our son, but we've got a house, we got a backyard, we got good food, and we love people. So why don't we just do that? And we just found that God builds his church that way. Like, it's not rocket science. But we also found along the way that when you grow up in church, you oftentimes think that that type of thing is for the paid professionals. And when you read the scriptures, it's for the normal peasants. There were no paid professionals back when that book was written. So everybody just had to live. The family was the primary means by which people heard the story of God and got to experience it. So we just thought, let's just do that now. But I finally finished the book. We had subsequently moved to Alton, Illinois, which is north of St. Louis, about 11 years ago, because our son kept surviving. He was supposed to have died when he was 5 or 6, and he kind of kept living. And we eventually found an assisted living center for him out in the St. Louis area. And so our family all moved out there. One day, Cheryl and I were actually at this little Italian bar, and we met a young lady that was our waitress. And over the dinner, I said, hey, her name was Sasha. I said, Sasha, what do young people do in this town? It's a very poor town. Average family income is only about $20,000, so it's the hood. And so I was curious, like, what do young people do in this town? And she said, all my friends just do drugs. She looked like she had that in her background. So I said, has that been a struggle for you? And she said, yes, sir. But she said, we're doing really good right now. And so we fell in love with her immediately. And my wife apparently fell in love with the town, because when we left the restaurant, Cheryl said, why don't we just move here and see if we can do something to help this town? And so we went back to Denver, where we were living, where our two daughters were. And they one was just brand new married, one was engaged, and both of the young men were there. And I rallied the whole family together, and I said, hey, I want you to hear the crazy idea that mom has. And so Cheryl just said, I think maybe we should go to this town. And she goes, we don't know how much longer Ryan's going to live, but I think it's more about the town. Like, let's go there for the town. And I told the boys, I said, hey, you don't have to come with us. Like, you don't have to follow us anymore. You guys need to live your own lives. And all of them said, well, no, we want, like, let's go do this mission together. And so my two adult daughters and the two son-in-laws, we all loaded up U-Hauls, and we all went out. And my oldest daughter, as we were looking for where to live, we said, well, let's all live right downtown. And my oldest daughter said, put me on the roughest street corner we can find. And I said, how about one block off the roughest? But she settled on the roughest corner. So we bought an old crack house for $12,000 and renovated that, put her and Matthew in that. And then we bought my other daughter a house a few blocks away. And then Cheryl and I were right in the middle so we can keep an eye on everything. And it was probably 6-8 months in. It was probably about, because we were working on this building that was given to us. And my youngest daughter drove up. She was on her way. She was working as a counselor at Alton High School. And she just drove by while I was working. And I just remember thinking, this is crazy that my adult kids they chose to be with us on mission. Like, we're together on mission. And I realized that was rare. And that's when I went, I'm going to go dig out that old Righteous Brood stuff and see if we can, because it kind of came full circle. I was starting to see my kids living the lives that we had lived. And I wish I could tell you more about my kids, because, like, they're the best missionaries I've ever met. Like, they could say, Dad, we're moving they could say anywhere in the world, and I go, you guys know how to live. Like, I'm not worried about you. Both my daughters led the league in ice hockey in penalty minutes. They're both super tough. But they both rescue people. They foster care babies and kids. And my daughter and my other son-in-law, they're about the only youth ministers in the town, but they're not ministers. They just work jobs. They're Jesse's athletic trainer and trains about 200 Alton kids. About 65% of all the kids in our city don't have a dad. And so those two have become like a little juggernaut. So that was the concept of the Righteous Brood. Like, what if we could live a big enough story as a family that our kids would go, that's the way I want to live. Like, I'm not going to settle for this religious stuff or just going to church. But, like, what if they were, like, all in, even after they're done with us? And what if that's how the church grows? As we pass down a story that's big enough to hold the attention of our kids and our neighbors and that type. So that was a lot on that one question.
No, that's
we're going to have to move a little quicker.
No, we're good. We're good. Let's lean into that family thing. You know, I think as Christian parents, sometimes we say, well, my first ministry is at home or with my kids.
Yeah.
Is that a helpful way to think, or can that idea maybe take us away from the mission?
Yeah, it usually takes us away from our mission. Because our first, you know, like if I were to ask you parents, what's your two primary things that you should be thinking about doing for your kids? I bet you most of us would say provide and protect, right? Sounds pretty good, right? And you do that for a while. But there comes a point as your kids grow, I think it's early middle school age, somewhere in there. Some kids mature later, some earlier. But once a child determines that they're now going to make their own decisions for their life, and you all have been there, it's a bad moment. but once they've decided, I'm going to run this show, what you want is for them to take ownership of their faith. And so the sooner you can get them to take ownership of their own faith, you know, you've been hauling them to church all these years and you make them pray before the meals and that type of thing. But at some point, you want to know that even if you're not around, that they know how to live and they know how to follow God. And so I think when we think about the role of parenting, I think we have to add, those two are important, but what if we could add develop and deploy as the other two things? And I'll tell you, those two will test you because I always like to say, if Hugh Halter could have just what Hugh Halter wants, I don't ever want my kids to follow Jesus. I want them to be in heaven, but I don't want them to follow Jesus because I know what Jesus does in the world. And I know that he goes to where things are broken and busted and dangerous, and I know that if they follow him, they're going to have to give their money up, and they're going to have to give their time away, and they're going to have to take risks, and they're going to, so like, what parent would really want that for, like, but when you watch it happen, you go, man, I can't believe, like, I'm so proud of them. So it's a very hard thing to get from being a churchy parent to a, I guess, like a missionary parent, where you view your life as you're on mission for God and you're trying to develop little missionaries. And so to me, it's a gut check, you know, all the way, and especially as they get to, I remember my youngest daughter, who also is very, very tough. In fact, a couple of years ago when she first had her first year at Alton High School, people were sending me videos. We had 19 gang-related fights on the very first day of school. They brought in every policeman in our town because everybody was fighting, and McKenna was a head counselor. So I'm getting videos, and my daughter is in the middle of 30, 40 kids breaking up fights, and I'm losing my mind. I'm like, why did we even move here? What have I done? And I'm trying to drive to the high school, but they're, you know, all these parents are trying to show up to, you know, it's just a bad day. And I'm trying to text McKenna. She finally texts me back, quit bothering me, I'm busy, and I'm fine. But this was McKenna, and I remember in high school, she jumped in the middle of a fight. Her best friend was getting beat up by her boyfriend at a party. And McKenna jumped in the middle of that, and it ended her D1 hockey scholarship. She got a severe concussion. He threw her through a window, and so I was trying to, I had lost my Jesus for a few hours. I was going to go try to, like, murder the kid, you know, type thing. And she wouldn't let, she knew where he lived. She's like, I'm not telling you where he lived, Dad. She said, remember, she pulled my hand down on her as she was on the bed, packed in ice. And she pulled me down on the bed. She said, sit down and calm down. She said, our whole lives, you and Mom have taught us that when we follow Jesus, sometimes we have to put ourselves at risk, right? I was like, yeah. You know, she goes, so whatever's happened has happened. Like, let's trust God. And so there's just been this interplay between my kids as they've gotten older where I've had to learn to go, Jesus, I really do want them to follow you. And even if it costs them, because that was really the story. When you read the scriptures, people were dying for their faith. It was a typical scenario where you didn't know what would happen. So the idea of, do I really want my kids to follow, would have been your greatest question. And if I would tell this to parents, if you can settle the issue that you really do want your kids to follow Jesus, like really follow him into the world, when you finally release that, something will change in what you do with your family now. Mm. You won't just go to church and pray before meals. You'll start thinking about, how are we living as a family in our neighborhood right now? Are we living in such a way it's developing these characteristics of a really robust, tough little missionary? So it's hard.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you have highlighted there, and obviously this weekend and some of your works, in that question, you have to define what ministry is, right? Because some of what you're talking about is that tension of ministry, coming here and having a great band and make sure you serve, and the pastor does an okay job, but that's not really the full picture of ministry. I'm not even sure that's a large percentage of ministry.
Yeah.
Because ministry is the everyday things of life. Yeah. Right,
it's living out your calling. So we never really talked much about ministry because our kids saw me pastoring churches, but we never, in those days, because we were more networks of little house gatherings all around the Denver Metroplex, we chose not to have anybody technically on paid staff. So they saw me painting houses and doing all sorts of other things. So they learned that ministry is how you do life. It's not, it doesn't have to be a paid thing. I always, when I see people that are sort of overseeing local congregation, I always feel like people like you, you're taking one for the team, honestly, because it takes a lot to help oversee. But the fastest, most nimble missionaries are actually you guys, because you're out there, like right now. Yeah. If he tells somebody at a local Starbucks, yeah, I pastor a church over there called Piedmont, it puts him 10 yards behind the line of scrimmage already, because people don't have a natural respect for the institutional or organized church much anymore. But when you say, yeah, I'm also a student at Wesleyan, or you say, you know, I'm a local plumber in town, you're right where you need to be the person that actually impacts that person's life. So it's not ministry, is life. Mm. Like we always say, like, you shouldn't need any outreach in your church, because we have roughly 200 outreachers. And if we could begin to live life like Jesus lived in the neighborhood, this right, what we're doing right now is a vertical experience. We're having time with God. But the people outside that God's called us to, they're probably never going to come in here. It's very rare that they would come in here. So you become, and by the way, your kids are the easiest way to connect with the world. Mm. It's like the front line of mission is what your kids are doing. We got to where, you know, the girls, we were in some sort of a hockey ice arena, or traveling. They were really good, so we were traveling all over North America. And I figured, we were 30 hours a week, both Cheryl and I, in that hockey. And you could go, well, that's going to pull you away from, like, how are you going to add that to your life and then go on mission? we said, no, wherever we're at is our mission field. So I went, well, we're almost a full-time missionary just in the hockey culture. So I stopped kind of complaining about all the time we had to spend. And I just remember one day when I decided I'm going to quit complaining. In fact, actually, I didn't decide. Cheryl said, why don't you quit complaining?
Thank you for the
honesty. And go to the hockey rink and spend some time with some guys. So I was like, fine, I will. So I went to the arena, and I only knew one guy by name. I'm like, hey, Joe, let's drop the girls off. It's freezing in here. Let's go get a cup of coffee. And he's like, that's a great idea. And so Joe and I went night one, and then two nights later, we were back at the same. So we were like, that was way better than freezing. So, and then all of a sudden, you know, Tim and Kevin are like, where are you guys going? We're like, we're dropping the girls off. We're going to get coffee. When I say coffee, I mean beer. We're going to go get a beer. Okay. So next night, it's four guys. And within, in fact, we got in trouble by the coach because she's like, y'all just drop your kids off, and now y'all leave. And so we had every dad on the team that was now going out. And then when we would do fly out to tournaments, I would always run a little devotion hour in the lobby of the hotel. And it's because of the talks that we would have with the guys, and they would say, hey, let's do that when we travel. And so, you know, mission is not something that you add to your life. Mission is everywhere you are. And you'd be surprised how many hours you can put in if you will see everywhere you're at as, and everywhere your kids are at. So all those, you know, all those times on the soccer stands, so you just sitting there, you're there. And it's the same parents and the same kids and it's the same coaches. So I don't think you have to add anything.
Yeah, that's great. Because that kind of, one of our questions was, I feel like people feel really stretched in life, right? You've got work, your marriage, you've got to be a good father or mother, you've got extracurricular activities and hobbies and all that, and then what happens, I think, oftentimes, they come to church and we go, hey, get in a missional community, mm-hmm. hey, serve for this event, hey, we've got a chili cook-off, hey, do this, and then everything they're doing is just going, man, this calendar is getting more and more full, and they have to pick and choose, and I think, it feels like what you're saying is, no, it's everything in your life is aligning to one thing. Yeah. Like, if you're going to work, you're still on mission.
Yeah.
If you're going to the ball field, you're still on mission.
Yeah, and we also, though, we viewed our family as a missional community. Mm. That's your, like, you can't even get away from it. So we're either kind of not that great as a missional community right now, or we've let many years go by where we never acted like a missional community, but our family, like, we worked together. They had a lot of friends that didn't have good families, so they'd always be going, hey, can these kids, like, bunk down with us? So we put a lot of kids up. We always had somebody living with us. We always had Sunday night was we called it family dinner night. And I actually did that because of how much time we were spending with people outside of our family. And I wanted to, like, circle the wagons and go, hey, let's just make sure we have our little time. And we did it for like two times, and then the kids kept inviting their friends over. And so family night became what we knew it was, is bring any of your friends that you'd love to have that don't have good family. And that family night became 30, 40 people every Sunday night. And they grew up with that as a normal way of life for our family. So guess what they do now? Yeah, they just have a lot of family dinners. They take kids in, and we never had to train them to do that. It was just a natural. They saw how much work that is, but they saw what it does for people, and they love that feeling of going, we're actually changing lives.
Would you say that you're an extrovert or introvert?
I'm an introvert. Yeah, I do not even like people.
Yeah, I figured. I thought
especially
so.
Don't like kids.
No, yeah. Yeah.
For
so this,
sure.
this is good. So I think sometimes I know that, like, my family, myself, my son, and my daughter are high extroverts, big E.
Yeah.
And my wife, she likes people, but she also likes her time.
Like some when they leave.
Yeah. And so I think I've talked to a lot of other families that have this kind of struggle and this idea of living on mission, and you know, you're mentioning parties and families and all these things. What does balance look like? And can you give us some, like, tangible, and I, well, maybe balance is the wrong word because I asked you this question yesterday and there is no balance.
No, I'll give you balance now.
Give us some tangible things of like what does life look like?
Yeah, it has to, for you to do life like in a natural way, you have to still be very intentional. So imagine Ryan's having seizures every hour, every night. So we were both kind of zombies. I would take the night duty and get maybe an hour of sleep and then go work, and then Cheryl would take Ryan during the day. So we had to have two coffees every day. We instituted two coffee times. So in the morning we'd get together, she would go, "How bad was it?" Same. Had 11 last night. And then we would always meet up around 3 o'clock. So if I was painting houses, I'd try to get home. But then on Sunday nights, we would plan the week together. We would look at our energy level. We would look at natural things that were going on. We'd look at the girls' hockey schedule. And then we would try to figure out, is there a night that we could have maybe just one or two couples over, a simple little meal together. And then weekends was always a Denver Bronco game. So we were the house that threw the party. But it got to where people just knew the Halters are always going to have the house open for a Bronco game. And people just knew those are the days you just bring your friends. And it got to where, you know, if we were exhausted, we would still do it. But we'd tell people in our community, "Hey, we're wiped this week. Can you guys handle all the food and can you clean up?" Cheryl would sometimes just go to bed at 8:30. She'd be like, "Peace out. I'm out. Love y'all. I don't even know who some of you are, but I'm going to bed." And I started to realize I didn't have to, like, close up the shop, because there's always one socially awkward person that has no friends that stays till, like, 1 in the morning, always. And I get to where I go, "Hey, Steve, I got to go to bed tonight. I haven't had much sleep, so, like, you're going home at 10:30 tonight." And it was fine. So, but we, as our community formed, we started to have 10 or 15 people that were on mission with us. And sometimes we had it covered, and we go, "We're good tonight. We'll run the show." And there were other times we went, "We're just going to provide a house for you to bring your friends to," and it worked out okay. But that's why, like, at some point, your missional community—it's your family, but it's also people that do life in your neighborhood or in your network that you can do life with. And you know, we did it early on. We didn't really want to have anybody into our house because Ryan, when he would have a seizure, he would oftentimes just wet himself. And it's a lot of work to get him in the bathtub. He was usually unconscious, so you're dragging a corpse down the hallway, and then you got to wrap him in a blanket and sort of figure out how to get clothes back on him. And we started to find that people actually wanted to help us with that. And when we stopped, we were never ashamed of it. We just didn't want to bother people with it. We found that people wanted to be bothered. They wanted to do life with us. And so we just, you know, most people in our communities, and we've started 30 missional communities over our 34 years of marriage. Most of them were a group of people that would hang together for a year or so. And they all took care of Ryan. They would all take his clothes off and bathe him and get him. So we just learned, like, you just present who you are to the world. And many, many people that came to faith when we would baptize them in a lake or in our backyard, when we would ask them to share how they found God, they would say, "Just being a part of this family, just being a part, watching you guys suffer well, and you just brought meaning." I mean, so, you know, when you're thinking about being a missional, you're not going out there to save the world. You're going out there to just represent your life in Jesus to people. And many of our lives are pretty messed up and messy. So, and so is, yeah, that's the world. So, you know, yeah, it helps to clean up the house before people come, but sometimes we didn't get there and we just had to learn it's no big deal. Maybe the bathroom, but that was it. So,
yeah, I think you highlight a special thing. If you're new in this missional community stuff, maybe you don't really understand it. Oftentimes churches have some sort of discipleship program, right? Yeah. Small groups, Bible studies, all these things, and they're good and well-meaning things. For us, we've kind of adopted this idea of missional communities to live out discipleship in the everyday things of life, and we talk about living as a family of servant missionary. And I think one of the unique things for me when I think of an MC is it's giving people a place to belong before they believe.
Yeah.
It's and so a lot of the other programs, and I've been in them, and I've run them, and I still think they're really good, what they do is they kind of function off of, hey, the church has a roster. Let's plug these people into smaller teams kind of deal so that they can have a space, right, yeah, in community. Yeah. And community is important.
Yeah, a little entryway connection. Yeah, it's nice to have a Bible study or something like that for sure.
But I also think there's people who are in your neighborhood that don't go to church, that don't believe in Jesus. You know what they need? They need community too. They need, I mean, ultimately, we all know that they need Jesus. And what if by opening our homes and just being human with them for a little while, like what if that could be an avenue that they could see Jesus in you? And it's just like Hugh's story of like, well, somebody gave us a place to kind of belong. And then through that, we saw the goodness of God.
And go back to even your words. We oftentimes have tried to get people into Bible studies, and we say so that we can be disciples, right? But when Jesus was discipling people, he was generally inviting them out to take a walk with him that day and go do something. So when you think about discipling your kids, yes, for sure. We spent time together with our kids in Scripture, but it never went great. You know, I always heard that we're supposed to lead our family. And so I would plan these like Bible study times where I go, okay, everybody round up, grab your Bibles. And about 90% of the time, one of my daughters wasn't in the mood. And she would just, I don't want to read. Okay, McKenna, would you read? Well, I don't want to read either. And then by the time we go, I got to send them to their rooms and ground them. And Cheryl would go, hey, that was super great. We should do more of that. So I learned that my daughters, but like if we were downtown serving in the poorest neighborhood, both my daughters were like, love that.
Yeah.
Love that. And so we just learned that discipleship has to be life on life. All those big talks you want to have with your kids about, well, you don't really want to have talks with them, but things that you should be talking to them about is sex and about awareness and about getting trapped and alcohol and all. Well, we had all those talks because we did all those things. Like we didn't do all the, you know. But like we threw so many parties, and the parties were always mostly full of people that didn't do the God thing or the church thing. And so every once in a while, they might have one too many. And in fact, one night this happened. One guy he actually came drunk. Nobody caught it, but he came in out of another scenario. He was kind of brand new to our community, but his wife and daughter were always on the hockey deal, so we knew them. And he came, and he became worse and worse as the night went on. Got very verbally abusive to both the wife and the daughter, to the point where in the middle of 40 people, I had to ask him out in the front yard. He thought I was asking him out to fight, so that's how he postured up. And I just said, we're going to drive home. And I took his car keys, and I said, I'm driving you home. And then I spent the night with him, and the wife and daughter spent the night at our house. And he woke up, and I was just sitting there. He's like, what are you doing here? And I said, do you remember last night at all? And he goes, no. I said, well, let me tell you how it went down. You were at my... And so we chatted that through, and I said, does this happen a lot? You have blackouts, and you get really abusive with your family. And he goes, I think it's, a couple times. And I said, well, don't worry. Your wife and daughter spent the night at my house. And I said, do you want to live like this? He's like, no, sir. So he's a younger guy. So he eventually did come to faith. But I remember that next morning when we had a little family therapy time in our house, when it was all over, I asked my oldest daughter, Allie, I said, you guys do okay last night? She goes, yeah, Dad, this is what we do, right? Mm. And but then the next day, I remember me and Allie, she was 13. I said, let's talk about booze. We've never really had an alcohol talk. And we had a great talk about, this is why we don't forbid it when we have people over. But yeah, every once in a while, it goes to the dark side. But we got it. We can handle that. And she's like, yeah. And so our kids didn't have an issue with alcohol growing up. When they would go to parties in the high school, they were always there to make sure their friends didn't drive drunk. So they had one of their friends that was killed, and they came to us, and they declared that they were going to go to every party in the high school. And so we had a family talk. We're like, if you can get two more friends to go with you, it's four of you, and you're going to go to make sure nobody ever drives drunk again, then that mission we're okay with. So that's kind of how we discipled our kids. And when it came down to sexual stuff or whatever, it came because that's what they were dealing with. And so by the time they're almost out of middle school, I think I could have sent them literally anywhere and they would have known how to navigate it. And they've seen the dark side and the light side, and they know how you manage it. And versus the parents that oftentimes you're so afraid that your kids would ever have any connection with anything bad, you never let your kids get out of the bubble. And then when they finally get out, they're going to struggle. So I would rather disciple my own kids through real life than let the world disciple them. You guys remember a guy named Manson, Marilyn Manson? Remember way back he made a comment, I think, on like Johnny Carson or something. He said, if you all don't disciple your kids, I will. And that's true. The world disciples everybody. It just means that they take their cues and their mindset and their worldview. And if you don't provide for them a living, working worldview that makes sense, then somebody else will fill that vacuum. And just taking them to church and praying before the meals does not provide a worldview. It might provide a theological deal, but when they, you know, daughter Allie, eighth grade, all of her Christian friends beat the crap out of one of the girls on her hockey team because she was lesbian. And so Allie declared to me when I picked her up that day, of course I was called by the principal because my daughter was in a fight. When we found out why it was, I was like, I was proud of her. But she got in the car, she said, Dad, I'm not being a Christian. I was like, I totally get it. She thought I was going to be mad at her. I'm like, are you still okay just following Jesus? She's like, well, yeah, but that's not an option, is it? I'm like, no, you can just follow Jesus. You don't have to be this way. And I said, by the way, in that middle of that fight in the hallway, where do you picture Jesus? She says, with me. I said, yeah, you've picked up the right things. So your kids learning how to be a non-judgmental Jesus person, they're only going to pick that up because you've modeled that. And they've seen us bring Sharon over, and Sharon smoked weed so much it would waft over our fence as our daughters were jumping on the trampoline, and I was worried about my own daughters getting high from secondhand smoke. But they saw us always invite Sharon over, and her smell would permeate our house, and they saw us just light candles and then just love on Sharon. So they learn, Mom and Dad don't judge people. Yeah, they prefer not to have that smell in the house, but they saw us do that, and then they saw us with this alcohol situation. We had so many. Our living room was like the bar scene from the first Star Wars movie. We had every complete jackwagon you could imagine. Gay, straight, any color of the rainbow, crazy worldviews, and they saw us have really fun conversations where they would always go, they saw Dad, okay, so we've talked about reincarnation and, you know, Casey and Joe, you from that, but let's just hear what Jesus has to say about afterlife. So they learn that every time Dad's going to put Jesus in the conversation, and it's just going to kind of angle towards him over time. So they're not these obtrusive people that try to go save people. They're just people that have learned, no, let's just get them in a conversation, and we don't care what they smell like or whatever. It's no big deal. And we've oftentimes said that a lot. Terrible things would happen, and we'd all sit around as a family and go, no big deal. We got this. So,
a lot of what you're talking about is gospel fluency and being able to just recognize and speak the language into all things, right?
Yeah.
But I think there's something that, as you were talking in my mind, what does it take for us to shift from wanting... Well, let me say this a different way. There has to become a shift. We want, as parents, we want to protect our kids. We want the best for them. We want to set them up. We've got all these dreams, and maybe not even as parents. Like, for ourselves, we have dreams. For our friends, all these different things. But there has to something in our relationship with God has to shift to go from this nice white house with a picket fence and a dog that never barks and craps in your floor. That never happened to me, by the way, multiple times a day, to this picture that you're talking about of being with broken people and not being higher than mighty with these broken people. What do you think has to shift?
I think, you know, very simply, reps. You know, you get good at whatever you do. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people. Again, I'm an introvert, so I never really, I love people, and I love people that didn't know anything about God. So it was very easy for me to make the invite every week. Hey, why don't you come over, bring your family. I love that part because it was an invitation into, we called it the vortex. Just get them in the vortex. usually a half hour before people are showing up, I'm like, oh, I wish I hadn't have done this.
And everybody said amen.
And then, you know, as the night's winding down, I was, you know, all right, they're almost gone. And but I think it was reps. It was common for Cheryl and I to just laugh in the morning and go, man, we didn't have the energy for that, but it was a really good night. And the conversations that happened, like something moved. We would say that a lot with our kids. Hey, stuff moved last night. So I think it's reps. You get a heart for what you do. So for at first, you have to kind of fake it till you make it, I think. You know, you got to force yourself. It has to be a part of your discipleship for you. If you go, look, I'm not that comfortable with people. Well, you can live your whole life. I mean, the Lord will let you live uncomfortably and never, you know, he just sort of invites us in. He never forces us to do anything. It's a Navy SEAL opportunity. I need 20 of you to step forward. I don't need everybody, but I need some of you to step forward and do a little bit harder mission, and you may not come back alive. I mean, that's the call to a missionary framework for your life and your family. So, but I do think you have to have that inward dialogue with yourself on, like, what is my ultimate goal for my kids? And it usually is that American dream goal, right? And you just got to think that through, because many of you, you're my age, I'm 60, so you've lived the American dream, and you can go now, oh, it's not that great. So why would I just want my kids to have a safe, upwardly mobile life that has very little meaning or sense of purpose? My daughters are just right around the age of 30. They've already lived a full life where we sit around and they go, we're exhausted, but it's been a great life. My youngest daughter almost died 2 years ago. She lost an 8-month-old baby and bled out. And we were sure, we had to life flight her into St. Louis because there wasn't enough blood to keep her alive. And the nurses told me to say goodbye to her in the ambulance. They're like, she probably is not going to get there. And we even had a moment where she was able to open up her eyes, and she made a comment. She's like, we're good. You know, so I just go, like, at the age of 30, for my daughters to know that they've done things that made the Lord smile. If the Lord were to take them, I'd be okay. I wasn't great. but I was like, yeah, I'd rather live a big, short life than a long, boring life. And that's the gut check for a parent and how you pray for your kids and how you release them. But they're probably not going to want the hard things of God unless they've seen some of that modeled in the lives of their mom and dad. So our kids, they got used to Cheryl and I. Needs were being presented all the time financially, and we didn't make a lot. So they always saw Cheryl and I sitting there. We had a game where if a need came up, we would write down what we think we should give to that, and then we would slide it to each other, and it was crazy. Over 35 years of marriage, we've only not hit the number like twice. We just had a sense, but then we started to invite our kids into that. So our kids watched us give, and we would talk about it. It's like, this is our last $400, and Dad doesn't have any work coming up in the next 2 weeks, but they need it right now. And so our kids watched us give sacrificially and generously and spontaneously. So guess what they do? They don't have any money either. And I always, sometimes I'll joke, I'll go, I just wish you guys would not follow Jesus so much. Just keep a little bit for yourself. So it's just still always as a parent's, we just want them to be okay. But then we realize that they're okay because they're in community with us. We actually teach people now that do life with us, because now there's lots of families that are with us that live like this. And remember those passages that say, hey, don't be anxious about anything? Those are not written to individual people. Those were written to a community. And you're able to say to somebody, you don't have to be anxious about what you're going to eat or drink because we're all together. You're all good. But when you say that in an American Christian church way, that doesn't hit with people because they go, I really don't have any backup. So don't just tell me it's going to be okay. But when you live life in a deep community, and a child is about to head off to college, and the moms share, hey, we don't know how we're going to pay for this other half of this. And then they see the community go, well, we'll help. When we see people that go, they may not have a meal for their kids, or this kid doesn't have a dad, he doesn't even know how to fill out his application to get to college. It's okay. Be anxious about nothing, kid. We got you. Like, we'll help you fill this thing out. It's like everything became, does that make sense? So again, our kids are watching this, and so it's going to come out of them. You disciple who you are. And if you're an afraid, upwardly mobile, American, far right wing, heavily political dad, guess what's going to come out of the hopper? Okay? You produce who you are. If what has come out of your life is a gentleness and an awareness of people around you, and you're always opening up your home, and there's this winsomeness about who you are, then guess what comes out of the hopper? So, parents, you are the most important element in the discipleship of your kids. And if they see you doing the church thing, but then they see you living like the rest of the world and you're always tied up in anxiety and you overwork and can never rest or play, then they're going to have an uptight Christian life. And they'll have a little belief system, but that'll be about it.
In wrapping up, if you were to give our family kind of one piece of advice, and maybe it's to parents or just all of us in general as a family, because it kind of takes a tribe to
yep, for sure.
Disciple and raise up the next gen, what would that piece of advice be?
Talk openly with your kids about your own faith. Not what you believe, but how you've been doing with it. So sometimes when parents hear this talk, they go, well, crud, I've already wasted 9 years. I always say the best way to make up time with your kids is to just simply restart your own discipleship after Jesus. And let your kids know, hey, Allie, you know that we have had a belief in God in this family and we've done the church thing, but I don't know if we've always modeled living life after Jesus very well to you guys. And your mom and I, we're going to try to get a little bit more active. So just pray for us. But I'm sorry that we kind of have just made this a church thing for you. Usually that's your best way to make up time, because then your kids get to then own whether or not they want to really. So that's the first thing. Just have open dialogue about it. And where you haven't done that great a job, they will be the easiest ones to just be thankful that you're honest and that's a real conversation. And then you can say, maybe we should start as a family, not just praying for the food. Why don't we just start taking 5 minutes and see if there's anything we could do as a family, maybe to help one person together this week or whatever. So to me, that would be the thing. And then I just think the secret sauce of family on mission is something related to eating and having people into your home or your backyard or something. Like, our kids knew that Cheryl and I have had 13 houses in 35 years of marriage. So do the math. About every 3 years, we would move. And the thing that we would do with our kids, we'd always get in the house and we would always go, how are we going to get 40 people in a room in this house? So our kids knew the house was not, again, the house was not for us. The house was for God. And that his family that he's building has to trump our nuclear family. So our nuclear family is not the most important thing. It's the family of God that he grows. So, you know, start taking your house, like figure out how to hang some string lights and make a fire pit and blow out a wall. We always made one extra room so that if somebody needed a place to live. And so maybe you just even just rethink your living scenario. And then move on to just start with party. Start with the sacrament of party, having people in for a meal, and just be normal. Don't try to talk about anything meaningful. Just don't try to talk to them about God. Just learn how to be a great human family. And I think you'll be off and running. So,
yeah. Thank you. Give it up for Hugh. As the band comes up and we kind of close out this morning, I just want to invite all of you to live on mission, to follow Jesus in the everyday things of life. We've got several missional communities that would love to walk with you through things. And let me just say this, we're not perfect. We don't have it all figured out. We fail. We do things wrong, but we serve a perfect God. Amen? Let me pray for us.